Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I spent much of last summer in London doing research, and it took me a while to realize that something about my routine wasn't quite right. I love my work at the British Library, and my days were filled with impromptu coffee breaks with colleagues who were soon to be friends, and thus fellow mischief makers. London is an amazingly cheap city to enjoy if you like museums like I do, so we were doing a lot of that as well. So my social life was together, and my professional life was together, but something still quite wasn't right. I found myself in strangely depressive moods. But then it hit me. Despite all the adventures and exploring I did, I never really went to places with trees or parks, which London is full of. And I'm a country mouse who grew up in a lush Middle Eastern village. And then my walk to the British Library every day was through a busy city artery in a trendy but mostly gray neighborhood. I took the tube or the underground everywhere, so I couldn't see trees in transit. My life, my routine, and to some extent, the way the city was built was affecting my mood. So on that same note, how cities affect our psychologies, we're talking to someone who weaves urban history with the history of emotions. Cairo and Berlin at the turn of the century, the 19th and 20th, that is. I'm Ene Mansour-Nadira, and today my guest is Joseph Ben-Prestel, who is an assistant professor of history at the Free University of Berlin, where he teaches global European and Middle Eastern history, and also was a postdoctoral fellow at the Orient Institute in Beirut for the 2017-2018 academic year. He'll be a fun global fellow at Princeton University for the 2018-2019 academic year. He received his PhD in modern history from the Free University in Berlin in April 2015. Before joining the same university's history department as professor, he held the position as a pre-doctoral researcher at the Center for the History of Emotions within Berlin's Max Planck Institute for Human Development. He is a co-founder and editor of the Global Urban History blog, which I encourage you to check out. It's an amazing blog, and it's how I came to know your work, actually, Joseph. And he is the author of many articles and a book, the subject of today's interview, Emotional Cities, Debates on Urban Change in Berlin and Cairo, 1860 to 1910, out 2017 from Oxford University Press. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, so here on New Books in Middle East Studies, we often start with a biographical question. So what is your own intellectual history, so to speak? How did you come to history writing as a profession?
Sure. So a long time ago, I began studying history, and I was lucky enough to have courses on global history. And I think this was very formative for me in the sense that this was a field that fascinated me. And it really helped my interest also in history that goes beyond Germany and Europe. And then in 2005, I happened to spend a summer in Lebanon, and I fell in love with Beirut. So out of this came kind of the idea that I wanted to focus more on the Middle East, and I wanted to learn more. So I started studying Arabic. I picked courses on the history of the Middle East. So since this point, I've been interested in, you know, combining global history and kind of the relations between Europe and the Middle East. And then as I went along in my studies, kind of accidentally, I stumbled upon different seminars on urban history. And in the beginning, I didn't have a specific interest in urban history, but through these classes, one of them was, for example, on the history of New York in the 20th century. Another one was on the history of Middle Eastern cities. Through these classes, I really became interested in urban history. And this made me think about kind of the combination of global and urban history. So out of my studies came this interest in trying to combine global and urban history and thinking about, you know, the histories of Europe and Middle East and the Middle East as they relate to each other when we think about cities.
So what intrigued me about your book and what made me pick it up was that it was a comparative study, and that's quite unique in contemporary history writing. So I suppose my question is, what brought you to Cairo and Berlin specifically, and what made you seek to put them into conversation with each other?
So in urban history, there's a number of studies that we could maybe call biographies of cities. So a lot of books actually focus on a single city. You know, you have a monograph, for example, on Paris or on Cairo or on Beirut. But as I came kind of also from this global history background, I was very early on kind of interested in how these different histories of different cities relate to each other. And I think this, you know, made me think about ways of comparing cities. And if we actually look at, you know, also these urban biographies, there are a lot of ideas and concepts and narratives that are used that are actually from the get-go informed by comparative observations. So we read about, you know, urban modernity, for example. We read about Paris as the capital of modernity, or, you know, an older concept that has kind of now disappeared, but is still kind of lingers on, is, you know, the concept of the Islamic city. And all of these observations are based on comparative observations. So what made me compare Berlin and Cairo was that I wanted to examine kind of the argument that the urban histories of Europe and the Middle East in the 19th century, specifically in the second half of the 19th century, are different. And often in urban history, there are these kind of containers of, you know, different urban histories of different world regions. So we would get, you know, an urban history of Europe. We would get an urban history of the Middle East, or an urban history of, you know, South Asia. So what I'm trying to do in the book is to think about these containers, specifically Europe and the Middle East, through a comparison of Berlin and Cairo, and really try to think what happens if we actually compare two cities that are often seen as being separate, as kind of belonging to two separate historiographies, namely the European and the Middle Eastern one. And this made me compare these two cities and kind of through this comparison to, you know, question whether these are really two separate stories.
What I actually really enjoyed about it was, I think your use of both cities really demonstrated to me that urban history isn't just the history of architecture, which was always my assumption going in. But in this book, you sort of, again, can see how the cities impact the way people think and the ways urbanization or being in an urban setting can have a similar but often different effect on different populations. So I sort of want to ask you about the state of the field right now. What possibilities exist for the history of cities in contemporary history writing, and what sort of trends are you really excited about?
There's definitely a strong focus on the history of urban planning and of architecture and kind of the built environment. if you will, within urban history. And this is still there, and this is still very present. But there's also been for a while now a social history of cities. And actually, specifically for the cases of Berlin and Cairo, you know, authors like Khaled Fahmy in the case of Cairo, or in Berlin, someone like Moritz Völlmer, have called for moving away from, you know, these histories of urban planning and looking more at these kind of social histories. So if you will, moving away from a history of cities as such towards a history of city dwellers. So there has been this kind of tendency for quite some years now. And of course, this interest can build on a long tradition in urban sociology. There's an ongoing conversation with also anthropology. And I think it is this kind of, you know, social history of cities that really drew me to the field. And one of the things that I think is quite exciting there is that urban history allows you to look at very concrete spaces and really actors on the ground, but to combine this kind of perspective with larger questions. And I think there, you know, this is something that has been really flourishing in recent years. A very good example of this, I think, is Will Hanley's recent book, in which he looks at the history of nationality and identification. So, you know, very large question, you know, that ties in with the global history of the emergence of nationality as a very dominant category in the 20th century. But he combines this with a history of Alexandria. And we really learn how people in the city, in their everyday practices, deployed nationality and how it played a role on a very kind of micro level. And it is this tendency, I think, that draws me to urban history. And this is something, especially with, kind of the rise of global history, that has become a very exciting and lively field, and kind of combining these global historical questions with an on-the-ground perspective, which really urban history can deliver in many cases.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned global history, because global history has also sort of become a trend, so to speak. I feel like we're coming into, right now, Middle East studies, we're coming into a period where we're opening up, we're not just writing histories of nationalism, we're writing social and more urban histories, as you mentioned, beginning, of course, the work of Khaled Fahmy, but continuing, of course, with people like yourself or Will Hanley. But we're also coming into a period where we're seeing more global histories being written about the Middle East, such as Tuful Abu Hudeb's recent book, A Taste for Home, has elements of global history. Sudhir Shaikh's work also has elements of global history. But one thing that's always sort of at the back of my mind, and this is just because the naysayers about global history have been so loud, and I identify as a global historian, is that global history is trendy, that it will sort of fall out of popularity soon. Isn't world history just global history? I open my email every now and then, and there's all these listservs that I'm on, these professional history writing listservs, and there's just these fights about what global history is, whether or not it's world history, what the history of Western civilization is. So what's your take on this? Is global history just trendy? And this is, of course, your book is oriented as a global history. What forms of global history are useful, and how would you define global history?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, it has been one of the big trends in the historical profession in the last couple of years. And that, of course, also comes with, you know, its pitfalls. I think that, the fact that there is an ongoing conversation and that there's kind of a controversial discussion around certain points is actually an encouraging sign, and is a sign for, for global history as being something evolving and as not kind of a category that now, you know, can be deployed everywhere we look. And I think that particularly the criticisms of global history in the last couple of years. So I'm thinking, for example, of a piece that Jeremy Edelman wrote last year, you know, in which he urged global historians to also look at, you know, concrete places and not to kind of only focus on networks and kind of the global planetary, if you will, kind of scale. And I think these are very important interventions, and they really enrich the field. I think that from my understanding, global history doesn't have to be a history of the world. It's not kind of a history of the whole planet. But global history, as I mentioned already with the example of Will Handley's book, can also focus on a very small and kind of concrete place and try to look at larger questions that, you know, have potentially kind of a global, refer to global structures, but look at these questions in a very small setting. So from my side, it is precisely this kind of combination of, you know, an interest in global structures, an interest in, you know, larger dynamics that, you know, we can see in a number of places, such as, you know, the rise of nationalism, for example, or, you know, the empire as a global force. But a study of these dynamics that is rooted in a specific locality. And I think this is for me kind of the most interesting kind of global history. And of course, as to be rooted in a certain locality, you know, that also means that it, you know, can draw on a specific archive. It, you know, can draw on the long tradition of area studies. It can draw on the kind of historiography on a specific place. And I think it is precisely in this direction, you know, that kind of interventions in the last couple of years have strengthened global history and might help to, you know, move away from the idea that once you do global history, you have to do the history of the whole world.
Yeah, I completely agree, partially because, well, again, I identify as a global historian, but I think a lot of what I do, I work on one or two languages. I don't necessarily incorporate all these different languages in but I also look at how, so I work on Arabic newspapers in the Institution of Arabic Newspaper Writing. And I think one thing that has to be acknowledged is, I mean, of course there are networks to be seen and to be studied. And you mentioned the example of Jeremy Edelman's work, but there's also something to be said about global influences and global perspectives, and those being ingested and espoused and reiterated in different ways. And then, of course, I mentioned the work of Tfoul Abu-Khudaym, who looks at Beirut as a city. She's also someone who works on sort of urban history, but specifically the social history and the idea of the home. But she looks at how global forces change Beirut. And again, the same with Sudus Shaif's work, which also looks at Beirut. To switch gears for a second, so as much as I enjoy talking about global history, one thing I enjoyed about your book is that you demonstrate, and I guess there's a bit of global history in what I'm about to say, how morality and emotions are intertwined in both Beirut and in Cairo. So what exactly is the relationship, as you see it, between morality and emotions? Because it seems very intuitive that our emotions are tied into how we act morally or how morality is seen. But how is it played out in both cities?
So there is, of course, there's a longer history to, you know, the association of emotions and reality in both places. But during the second half of the 19th century, the relation between morality and emotions becomes a more pressing issue, mostly due to two dynamics that we can observe in the two cities. So one of them is urban change. And so we can observe in Berlin and Cairo that, you know, these cities change tremendously. There's population growth, there are new neighborhoods, there's kind of economic restructuring, you know, new jobs that that we can observe in these two cities. A number of changes really that transform these two settings. And for contemporaries, and this is kind of the, you know, at the core of my book, for contemporaries, these changes affect emotions and, you know, transform them, if you will. So for this reason, you know, this longer association between emotions and morality, becomes more pressing because something is changing. And for these contemporaries, you know, the transformation of emotions, you know, brings these questions about morality to the fore as well. The second dynamic that is important in this context is kind of the rise of the natural sciences and, you know, findings about emotions in the natural sciences. So, for example, there are certain findings in, you know, physiology and thermodynamics that for a number of contemporaries raise new issues about emotions. And this is really, you know, not just in a purely scientific discourse, if you will, but, you know, since you mentioned periodicals earlier, periodicals are a great source to see how, you know, these debates about emotions re-emerge towards the end of the century. So, you know, you would find, for example, people writing letters to, you know, a magazine like Al Hilal asking, what is love? Is it kind of a natural thing? You know, is it, if you will, a natural force, or is it something ideal? Is it a social, more of a social convention? And these are debates that are very similar in the two places. So what I'm trying to say with this is that the connection between emotions and morality that has a longer history begins to shift during the second half of the 19th century. And the kind of the findings in the natural sciences indicate to contemporaries that emotions are rooted in the body and that the body plays a, you know, very kind of prominent role when we think about emotions. So in a way, morality becomes more kind of anchored in the body through that. So when we think about emotions as, you know, being important for morality, and when we think about emotions as being a bodily phenomenon to a large extent, well, then morality has to do something with bodies. Kind of even opens up the possibilities of, of training the body in a way that it becomes more moral. So this is something we see, for example, with the emergence of physical exercise in the two cities, you know, that there is this idea of, you know, training your body and that this doesn't have just an effect on, you know, muscles and nerves, but it also has an effect on emotions and therefore on morality. So this longer history kind of changes, and the change of the cities and the findings in the natural sciences kind of make the relation between morality and emotions shift.
What I really appreciated about different elements of what you just said is we can see the continuity and the rupture to our current day in the way that exercise or productivity, which are both things that are associated to some extent with cities, are still seen as moral goods. We're only just reaching a point in our culture where we're having conversations about whether or not self-care and health should always be touted as positive qualities. In this conversation, we forget if we come from specific contexts, just the American context, or these conversations have reverberations at different and also different forms or parallels in different parts of the world. With exercise in particular, and you mentioned Wilson Jacobs' book. No, Wilson. Oh God. Another thing I appreciated about the book was that this was a history not specifically about gender, but it featured gender and women. That is to say, it wasn't a gender studies text, but it featured women to an equal extent as it did men. And I thought this was quite a progressive move, believe it or not, even though it's quite instinctive that women and men both occupy cities and are you know, 50-50% of the population. But you featured both populations and you treated it very naturally. And in particular, the relationships between the genders and how women behave, it has an impact on how morality is seen, because often women are seen as a measure of society's, I mean, they're sort of society's morality barometer. So how do gender relations shape cities and the emotions experienced within them?
So gender relations are quite central to these kind of processes of change that I just described that happen in the two cities. And I think when we look at emotions, in these instances, this becomes quite obvious. And also the connection of, gender relations and power becomes quite obvious. So we get this, in different kind of texts, is often, the idea that, men and women feel differently. I mentioned that the body plays an important role, especially, during or towards the end of the 19th century. So, of course, there's the question, well, what is the difference between a male body and a female body in terms of feeling? And I also mentioned sports and physical exercise, should women also participate in physical exercise? Should they kind of strengthen their body, et cetera, et cetera? So this kind of the importance of the gender difference is important, or is kind of obvious in a number of sources for that. And I really think that what this helps us to understand is that these debates are tied to concerns about power and tied to concerns about social distinction. So one way in which the argument of gender difference and emotions comes in these debates is really to exclude women, for example, from certain practices, but also to kind of justify certain forms of social control. So in Berlin, for example, the debate about, there's a debate about an entertainment district around the Friedrichstrasse, a central street in Berlin. And then very soon, contemporaries observe that there are single women walking on the street, in the evening. So this becomes a concern, and the police becomes active, and there is a strong policing of these women. So we see kind of the idea, that this entertainment district is destroying people's emotions, that it's too exciting, it's dangerous, it makes people nervous, et cetera, et cetera. We see how this is tied to also kind of a control of women and a kind of an attempt to make sure that single women are not walking on the street. And of course, when we think of Cairo, and Liat Kosma has written this fantastic book on the policing of women, we also get a strong sense of how these kind of processes of urban change were seen as affecting gender relations, and how there is kind of an effort of controlling this and controlling kind of women also in this in this world of the changing city. So I think, in short, gender relations help us to understand the larger question of power relations in these cities and how kind of, you know, these power relations are inscribed into, you know, the transforming urban space, and how especially middle class men are very concerned about, you know, the effects of a changing city on power relations in both places.
So this is a story of what is traditionally thought of as an Eastern city and then a Western city. So Cairo and then Berlin. But I think one of the stark differences between the two is that with regards to Cairo, this is also a period of colonial power with regards to the British. So how do we think of modernity? How much of globalization should be termed as an encounter between the East and the West? Is Cairo simply reacting to the West?
I do think that, you know, colonialism is a central kind of difference, and it's a very important element of the story that I'm trying to tell in the book. What I try to do in the book, however, is to move away from, you know, thinking of these two cities as belonging to two separate compartments, if you will, you know, the West and the East, or, you know, Europe and the Middle East, or, you know, there are various other compartments that we could think of. And of course, what these compartments do, and I think here Cairo is, you know, a prime example, is to think of, so if we use these compartments, you know, it happens very easily that the result is a narrative of, you know, a history of Westernization, for example. I mean, this, you know, people have written about this for Cairo, that, you know, as Ismail starts to kind of redesign the city in the 1860s, you know, this is the chapter of Westernization of Cairo. And other authors, you know, Adam Mestian, for example, have rightly criticized, you know, this narrative, also the narrative of Paris on the Nile, and, you know, various other ideas that come with it. So what I'm trying to do is to look at the two cities, not as being, you know, the same, but outside of this lens of, you know, the West and the East. This doesn't mean that, you know, we have to discard kind of the category of colonialism or of empire or, you know, any other specificities. They're quite important. But I think what it helps to do is to think about, you know, for example, how these forces of empire or forces of capital affected both cities, Berlin and Cairo, in different ways. You know, of course, there are important power hierarchies that, you know, we have to think about, you know, the, of course, Berlin kind of itself being kind of the center of an empire and Cairo, you know, being, you know, affected by the British and the Ottoman Empire and not being kind of the center of an empire itself. But I think, you know, if we think about how these kind of larger dynamics affect the two cities, we can also move away from ideas of, you know, for example, of import or of copying. So one of the things, you know, that this Westernization story about Cairo did was that we think of certain changes that happened in Cairo as being a copy of something that had been done earlier in Paris, you know, certain innovations in urban planning, for example. You know, the building of boulevards and, you know, of the Cairo Opera, et cetera, et cetera. And we can move away from this, you know, lens of copying and really try to think, how is it that we see these similar dynamics in Berlin and Cairo? Because in these two cases, they don't spring from direct interaction. So there's very little kind of direct transfers between the cities, you know, especially in comparison to other cases such as Paris and Cairo or Istanbul and Cairo. So what I'm trying to do in the book with this is move away from these kind of sealed compartments or boxes and think of the history of these two cities as being relational, which doesn't mean that, you know, we should move away from, you know, categories of colonialism and empire, and also from looking at differences between these two places.
Now, I want to note that your book does a particularly good job of noting what colonial populations do to the city of Cairo, which oftentimes when people want to push back against the modernity narrative, often when they want to push back against the East-West dichotomy and this narrative of reaction to the West, what they do is they ignore the West completely, and a lot of excellent studies have suffered from this. But you're very careful and you note sort of where foreign populations in the city are more present and how they affect the city. And their voices are there as well, because these cities are both sites of movement within themselves, but also movement to these cities. But I also tend to think of cities as within. There's also another way of thinking about cities. It's center and the periphery. And with urban history in particular, I think we think that it's simply the history of the city. But who's sort of excluded from urban history? Is it just those who don't live in what we think of as urban locales? Can we recover those voices? Is it difficult to find archives to do that particular work?
Right. So in urban history, of course, we, on a very basic level, you know, there are similar challenges as with other history writing. So, you know, there are certain groups that are very easy to find in the archive, and there are other groups, you know, that it's very difficult to kind of recover their voices. So, of course, when we look at, you know, these magazines and kind of, you know, the written record, if we look at books, etc., there is a very strong presence of, you know, the male urban middle class. And that's true for both cities in this time period. So what I try to do in the book is to combine, you know, focus on these kind of magazines and, you know, and other publications where people talk about urban change, to combine this with other sources, namely police and court records, in order to get, you know, at urban dwellers who didn't leave behind this kind of extensive record of reflections about urban change. You know, these would be lower class actors. These would be, you know, for example, so women who worked in the entertainment industry, really a variety of people who lived in the cities. And I think police records and, you know, court records are often a very, very good way of accessing these voices. And so in this case, you know, but that's a challenge that is true for, you know, all kinds of history writing, that, you know, this figure of the so-called subaltern, you know, how can we recover these kind of voices? But there's another important part, I think, to your question. That is, of course, that if we do the history of cities, it is important to keep in mind that there are also other spaces, and particularly, of course, you know, what we might call the rural, or, you know, the non-city. And I think in a number of ways, these stories also come or play a role in urban history and come into, you know, the things that are happening. So, of course, the cities are not islands in these moments. So we get people trying to sell their produce from the countryside in the city. We get people moving in and out. There's a variety of actors that actually moves between the countryside and the city in Cairo as well as in Berlin. And these actors, you know, pop up in the record. Actually, in both cases, for example, we also get the figure of the landholder, you know, who comes into the city to these famous entertainment districts, you know, to Asbakia or to the area of Friedrichstrasse, and, you know, they spend a lot of money, but then they don't stay in the city, but they go back to their rural estates. So in that sense, you know, these other stories, from the non-city, if you will, they play a role and they come in. So I think it would be wrong to conceive of this, you know, as kind of a dichotomy between urban and rural, but actually, you know, there's quite a dynamic interaction between the two. And although this is, you know, in a way, not the focus of the book, but I do think, you know, that when we look at these records more closely, we'll see that, you know, that there is this interaction and that it's not a strict dichotomy that in which we should think about these two spaces.
I think something else, and you pay quite a bit of attention to this in the book, complicates the idea of the city or the non-city and the rural and the urban, which is suburbs. And I'm going to make a massive assumption here. It seems to me that suburbs begin to appear, at least with the case of Cairo, in the 19th and early 20th century. And even in the American context or the European context, it seems to be quite a recent phenomenon. In fact, to my knowledge, the way cities grew in the U.S. and Istanbul is another example, it had just absorbed villages. And you can sort of see this in the way that different neighborhoods are named. They'll have some remnant of the fact that this was once a town or a village. So what about suburbs? Where do they sort of lie? I mean, very clearly this isn't quite, these dichotomies don't quite always work, but how do you incorporate suburbs, or how should we speak about suburbs?
Yeah, that's a great question, I think. I mean, so suburbs are a very good example of, you know, of showing that, you know, this dichotomy doesn't quite work, and that suburbs in a way, you know, incorporate characteristics of both of these places. And this is actually what, you know, what also drives their development. So at the end of the 19th century, as you mentioned, you know, we get these new projects of suburbs in Berlin and Cairo, you know, famously, of course, in Cairo, Heliopolis, but also a place like Helwen. You know, in Berlin, it's places like Lichterfelde or Frohnau. And if you look at, you know, for example, the promotional material that, you know, the builders of these, or the companies that created these suburbs produced, if you look at, you know, magazine articles about them, and, you know, a host of other sources, what you'll find is that they were promoted as a way of, you know, combining city life with the benefits of the rural. So it was, you know, the idea was that you could get away from the city and, you know, kind of enjoy the positive emotions of living on the countryside. You know, you would become a more rational human being, you would become calmer, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you kind of, the idea of the countryside as providing the real and true emotions, whereas the city would, you know, only have these superficial and very kind of nervous and quickly changing emotions. But at the same time, the suburbs would allow contestants to still work in the city and to kind of, you know, do, of course, the commute. So the idea was that urban dwellers who wanted to move to the suburbs wouldn't have to give up city living. They would just be able to combine kind of the benefits of the rural with, you know, their daily life in the city. And then if they, you know, for work, they could go back into the city. But also, you know, and this is something that, for example, promotional material always stresses, you know, they could go to the theater, you know, they could still visit their friends in the city, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, suburbs are really kind of, you know, the idea of marrying urban and rural, which comes out of this debate about urban change in both places at the end of the 19th century. So in that sense, you know, they're a very good example for, you know, moving away from the dichotomy of urban and rural and thinking about actually how these two categories, you know, inform each other and how contemporaries try to, you know, combine the best of the two.
So I mentioned earlier that nationalism was very, very big in Middle East history for a very long time. And to some extent, we still see traces of this. And I want to be clear, it's nationalism, sort of not nationality, like the work of Will Hanley, even though there's definitely elements of nationalism there. But I do have to ask, where does nationalism factor, if at all, into the history of both Cairo and Berlin?
So nationalism does play, or begins to play, a quite prominent role, especially towards the 19th century in these two stories that I'm trying to, or that I'm telling in the book. So one of them is that, as I mentioned, you know, there was this idea of these superficial urban emotions that, you know, would be irrational, they would move fast, you know, they would drive middle-class men, for example, to do irrational things. And what we can see in these publications is that the national movement in Egypt, but also authors in Germany who, you know, were interested in the nation, argued that these emotions kind of hurt the nation. And they're in the German case, for example, they're un-German. So in a way, you know, the city becomes a problem for nationalism because it is seen in both cases as, you know, as being detrimental to the nation. So there's this fear of a decline, you know, of a weakening of especially, you know, emotional men that would make it impossible, for example, in the Egyptian case to overthrow colonialism. So there was a fear that, you know, all of these Orientalist stereotypes about, you know, irrational men, they wouldn't be true to begin with, but actually what would happen in a place like Asbakia would be that Egyptians would actually become irrational, and especially Egyptian men. So there's this relation that, you know, when you look at, for example, some medical texts that were published in Cairo, you know, there's also within the discussion of emotions, there's also, for example, the category of, you know, of love for the nation, or, you know, hope al watan, that is discussed in this kind of context. And here again, you know, suburbs are seen as kind of a cure to that, or are promoted as a cure to that. So you would find some authors, you know, who would even make the link of saying, you know, suburbs do not only provide a solution for these problematic emotions of urban dwellers, but through that, they would help, you know, to strengthen the nation, to usher in a reform that is needed for the German or the Egyptian nation to become strong again.
You've mentioned repeatedly throughout this conversation the sources you used. And I want to sort of ask a parallel question, which is, I often feel at this point in time, in 2018, that the Middle East is suffering from an archives crisis. And of course, a lot of this is due to political and social upheaval in the region. And of course, you know, human suffering must be placed above the writing of history when it is as extreme as it is in the case of the Syrian revolution, the Syrian civil war, or just the extreme institutional violence that happens on a day-to-day basis in Egypt. But I was wondering sort of what is your method of coping, as someone who is a practitioner, a history writer, of coping with increasingly dire access to resources?
So this is a very, very important question. And in a way, kind of my experience reflects a moment, especially my experience for this book. You know, now it's obviously different with newer projects, but my experience with this book reflects a moment that has passed. So I did most of the archival research for this between 2011 and 2013. So I did the project in 2010, and then, you know, the Egyptian Revolution happened. And it was, you know, 2011 to 2013, I think, was a very specific time period to do research in Egypt. And it was also a period where access was possible. And, you know, there were, I remember in especially in 2011, you know, there were very exciting discussions going on also about, you know, opening up the archive, whether, you know, the National Archive could be opened up in a broader fashion, and, you know, what historians could contribute, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, you know, I was able to use the National Archive and, you know, Dar al-Kutub, and you know, also I worked at the American University in Cairo. So in that sense, it was quite a specific moment. And I think that obviously has changed since 2013. At the same time, one of the things that my project also kind of struggled with, obviously, is when you do European and Middle Eastern history and try to combine the two, you're working with two very different archival situations. And here again, you know, that is a challenge, and particularly when we think about global history, when we think about questions of access, and, you know, when we think about, you know, the importance of putting the history of different world regions, you know, on a in a comparative framework, we have to struggle with this question of very different archives and very different access policies. Having said, you know, that it's a difficult situation often, I think one of the things that also leads to is that people do actually quite creative things, and there are quite a number of initiatives, you know, that help to overcome that. So, for example, for my project, I used a database that Adam Mestian and Til Gralad is another person who's involved in that. I have created the Jaraid database on Arabic periodicals, which is very helpful in kind of tracking down, places where I could find certain periodicals, and, you know, tracking down who, you know, published what at which moment. And that is something that, you know, you wouldn't find, for example, for the German context. And that's, you know, that's quite a, you know, very creative and useful project. Another way in which, you know, I was able to circumvent some of the difficulties of getting access to archives was using the consular court records in London, and also in Berlin and in Vienna. So the consular court records, you know, that is a source that, you know, for example, Jill Hanley has extensively, you know, drawn on in his book. They often provide, you know, court cases and police records, you know, and individual cases from Cairo that you wouldn't otherwise kind of get, or they provide access to, you know, police records for the post 1880 period that are very difficult, if not impossible, to get hold of in Egypt. So it is a difficult question. I think that at the same time, you know, it creates these creative ways of managing and of exchange, which often help quite a lot.
No, I absolutely agree. Partially because I think it also makes researchers a little bit more, it gives them a little bit more of a push to ask questions and to go places they normally wouldn't, to go and see if different legations or different unions have archives or different museums, and also to begin to question what an archive is. Is it always the national archives, as in the case of Egypt? Or if you ask around, is there someone who has Acacia documents? Is it going to, I mean, there's a really interesting dissertation that's being written by a PhD student named Annie Gall at Georgetown, where a lot of her sources, she's working on the history of food, she got from antique booksellers. And she looks at the margin notes. And I mean, it's just, we do need to be pushed at the same time. So there's a sense of it being both a blessing and a curse. So on that same note, what are you currently working on? Can you give us a bit of a teaser? Any other projects in the lineup?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on a project that, you know, is on a very different time period. So I leaped forward 100 years. And I'm working on the relations between the radical left in West Germany and Palestinian groups during the 1960s and 1970s. So in this project, I'm interested in, you know, how these relations were created. There was, you know, quite a lot of exchange happening, especially after the 1967 war. So I'm looking at kind of the emergence of these relations and how they were made. From there, what kind of transfers came about from this kind of entangled history.
Oh, that's so exciting, particularly because this is such a rich time to be working on different Palestinian political groups in the 60s and 70s, such as the PLO, for example. I mean, you have the Palestinian Liberation Organization, just because you have people like Tuful Abu Hodeim working on it, Jonathan Gribetz, to some extent, Francis Hasso. And then there was recently a documentary that was released using footage that was collected across the globe from the Palestine Film Unit. So it's just, it's interesting to see this chorus of voices growing on this particular issue. Well, I want to congratulate you on the new book and wish you the best of luck with upcoming projects. It is a really phenomenal book.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.